I'm on this side of the church, but I could be on that side because my eyesight's like lankered. Okay. Okay, so Genesis 1, we go for it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for the signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give them light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give them light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens." So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kinds." And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work, all that he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his works that he had done in creation.
Thanks, James. That was brilliantly read. This is the second time in my preaching career that I'm preaching on this topic. And there are very few things. I can't think of many areas where I have had a change in the way I would preach on something. But this is one area. And so if you were at the Rochester meeting 2.5 years ago when I preached on this. You might notice that I have a slightly different tone and I have a slightly different take on certain things. Evolution and Genesis, we can throw the slides up, please. Tonight is going to be more like a lecture and less like a sermon. It's a topic that we simply have to do, not because the text demands it. In fact, I don't think the text demands it at all. And there are a lot of commentaries, a lot of the great commentaries in the book of Genesis give a very small amount of time to this topic. And to be honest with you, if it were down to my preference, I would not be doing this one. But we simply have to, because of the culture in which we find ourselves in, this modern Western intellectual culture, where many of us have grown up in schools and universities where we've come into contact with the Darwinian theory and the grand theory of evolution. And because there is so much controversy within the church around it, we simply have to address the topic. And so tonight, I've decided that I'm going to address this more like a lecture. I'm going to rush through. There's going to be two parts to tonight's sermon. Part one, just looking at some broad areas, broad definitions. And then part two is the really important stuff, the things that are non-negotiables for those people who want to hold to the idea of Jesus Christ being Lord. And so what we find from time to time is that this topic of evolution is a stumbling block for people to come to faith in God. And so part of tonight's message and part of our responsibility as the church is to make sure that we remove this stumbling block and to do all that we can do to help people see what is important when it comes to having faith in Jesus Christ and what is important when we come to the Bible. So first of all then, let's dive straight into it, and we're going to start off with looking at four different takes on evolution itself. So four different takes on evolution itself. The first one is the atheistic view of evolution, then the three that follow will be Christian views on evolution. So first of all, the grand theory of evolution. Many of you will remember this from your days in biology in high school, or potentially if you are studying in this particular field at UCT. Three kind of cornerstones to this view is, number one, everything has evolved and there is no intelligent supervisor. And so this is an atheistic worldview. It means that everything existed purely by chance, that there was nobody behind the scenes doing it. And every world religion that claims that God was there and that God was the one who created are mistaken. Those who hold to this view hold to this view despite the fact that it really is such a minute probability that it happened. Generally speaking today, everybody accepts that the probability of evolution happening as we have come into contact with it in our schools and with our universities, the probability of this happening is so incredibly minute. For me to put the number up on the screen would be absolutely ridiculous. I thought I'd rather do it this way. I know some of you here are thinking to yourselves, jeepers, it's highly unlikely that I'm ever going to get married at this rate. Or some of you might be thinking, jeepers, it's highly unlikely that I'm going to meet that deadline on Friday. Or it's highly unlikely that I'm going to pass this course. Have you ever been in one of those situations? Well, let me put it this way. If you can take that hopelessness that you've ever felt around that particular issue, and maybe you're here tonight thinking, jeepers, I've really got no chance of getting married. I hope you don't feel like that. But from time to time, us single people go like that. I remember when I had a moment like that. Take that feeling and multiply it by infinity to the power of infinity, and that's the probability of evolution happening. And so we would say if evolution were to happen, then we would say, then you would be married by the end of my sermon. You know, it would be that simple. The chance of evolution happening takes the chance of absolutely everything else and kind of makes it seem like a foregone conclusion. Potential hurdle, many people who hold to this theory will say, well, we know it happened because it happened, and that is the answer that they give. The second kind of cornerstone is that every living thing has evolved from the simplest life form. So once again, many of us will be familiar with this, the idea that every living being came from a common ancestor. And then thirdly, absolutely everything about us is the product of evolution. And so if we are prone to worship, it's because we have a worship gene within us. If we are generous, it's because mankind had to become generous in order to survive. And so the product of everything that we do. The sum total of everything that we do is a product of evolution. Okay, let's move on to then to theistic evolution. So that's the macroevolution theory or the grand theory of evolution. It's an atheistic view of evolution. As I said, the first one is the non-Christian view of evolution. The next three kind of takes on evolution are Christian views. So the first one is the theistic view of evolution. Theistic, trying to kind of accommodate the idea of evolution around the idea that with the word theistic, meaning that theistic, it's a God evolution, it's a God story. And so the three kind of cornerstones to theistic evolution are that evolution as a science correctly portrays the mechanism God used to create the world. So as a science, evolution is correct in terms of how we understand how God created the world. It has the same kind of second cornerstone to the previous one. Every living thing has a common ancestor or comes from the simplest life form. But then because of the theistic evolution understanding of man's propensity to worship, and because their understanding that mankind is different to the animal world, their kind of third cornerstone is that humans are unique in ways that defy evolutionary explanation. So previously, everything that about us was explained by evolution. This view says now, no, there are things about us, unique about us, that defy the evolutionary process and point to our spiritual nature. Many people who hold to this view point fingers at the next two views that are to come. There are many scientists who hold to this particular view or a strand of this view. And their common kind of accusation is that many Christians who hold to the views that I'm going to come to in the next two slides, many Christians who hold to those views make the idea that evolution is false such a central issue to the presentation of the gospel that there are countless, numerous people out there in the scientific world who've come to accept evolution as a scientific fact, and therefore, as seekers of the truth of Jesus Christ, are unable to enter in because so many Christians are creating this barrier. And so they have a genuine heart for seekers in the scientific world, as well as a number of scientists who've come to believe that this is the way that God created. And I'm sure that there are some of you here tonight who hold that view. So the third view is creationism. And once again, this is a Christian view. Creationism holds strongly to the belief of a young earth. I'm going to get into that just now, what that is. It holds strongly to the view of a young earth. The kind of general, one of the main slogans of creationism is that if you don't take Genesis 1, which James just read so brilliantly, if you don't take that literally, then the rest of the Bible kind of falls down on top of itself because we can't pick and choose what we need to take literally. Proponents of this particular view will say that Genesis 1 is supposed to be read literally, and if we incorporate our scientific understanding and try and shift around the Word of God, we then create a shaky ground where Scriptures itself will then be undermined by anything that we think is a fact because of the scientific world. And so those who kind of find themselves in this type of a fold have a strong view that the world was created in six literal 24 days. So as James read, they would hold to those as literal 24-hour periods. And they also hold strongly to a worldwide flood, which we'll read about later on in the book of Genesis, the story of Noah. And so for them, the earth is young, and there was a worldwide flood. And for them, fundamentally, evolution is flawed from a scientific point of view. And so many of the arguments go along the lines not only of theological arguments, but often there are scientific arguments that are presented. And so often you'll hear people say, the fossil records are incomplete. Darwin kind of had this idea that there were missing links, and the idea was that in time we would discover those missing links, and the argument kind of goes along the way that while we haven't found those links, those fossils haven't been found, and the fossils that we do find, we just pretend that they're actually Neanderthal men and they aren't really, and they were actually other animals, and so the fossil record itself has been misinterpreted. One of the common arguments here is that it breaks the second law of thermodynamics, which typically means that everything tends towards disorder, not order. And so one of the big arguments is that you can't have order. You can't have order coming from a Big Bang, or you can't have order coming. You can't move from one lower degree of energy to a higher degree of energy. And so the theistic evolutions will shout back at this and say, no, it doesn't defy the second law of thermodynamics in any way. And then the creationists will shout back and they'll say, yes, it does. And then the theistic evolution will shout back and say, no, it don't. And then we'll have like a two-year-old shouting match between the two. And so that takes place between these two kind of schools of thought. But the creationists say it defies the laws or the second law of thermodynamics. Creationists will say that the data and research that evolutionists present is misinterpreted. And so it's interpreted in a way because scientists come to the idea that evolution is true, and therefore when they come to the data, they interpret it in a certain way. They say that the dating techniques are flawed, and you'll often hear this line, it's just a theory. I've said it before myself. I'm sure many of you have heard it said before. And so they kind of go at the evolution theory on a scientific base. The next one is intelligent design. If we can have the next slide up. Thank you so much. You're doing very well. And here the intelligent designers, these are once again are Christians who disagree with the theory of evolution. But they could hold to either a young or an old earth. And once again, stay where you are. I'm going to get there about a young and old earth in the next two slides. But intelligent design, so the three kind of cornerstones to intelligent design is that evolution creates an atheistic worldview and therefore must be resisted by believers. So kind of one of the core ideas here is that if you allow evolution to be the foundation of your understanding of how God created as opposed to Genesis 1 and the Word of God, you then are placing science above the Bible, you're placing science above Scripture, and you're agreeing with something that can naturally conclude to the fact that there is no God. And so if you as a Christian subscribe to the idea of evolution, you're subscribing to an idea, so they say, which puts you on shaky ground because this idea that you're subscribing to now is based on an atheistic worldview. And so therefore it should be resisted by believers because the foundation is shaky. They'll once again agree with all the stuff that creationists said before, that evolution is fundamentally flawed from the scientific point of view. And then finally, evolution is flawed because it cannot account for the intricate complexities of nature. One of the examples that's often given is the eye, and so that's where the name intelligent design comes from. The eye and many of our other organs are so incredibly complex and technical that there's no way that they could have possibly evolved into the condition that they're currently in because it would have required them to be active in some sort of way beforehand. The kind of one of the often examples given is the bombardier beetle, which very simplistically, it gives off two different chemicals in order to protect itself. And if it gives off these chemicals at the wrong time or in the wrong way, it blows up because it creates an explosion. And so the idea is that it could never have evolved because it would have just destructed itself every time it tried to evolve. Once again, the theistic and the macro evolutionists will come back at these ideas and these examples, and they will argue against them, sometimes very convincingly, that these things are false and that, in fact, many of these structures could have evolved. And sometimes they point to the fact that theistic evolutionists and evolutionists, those who hold to evolution, will come back at this. And sometimes they'll point to the fact that the eye, even though it's so intricate, actually isn't perfectly designed. So they say there are elements that could be better designed in the eye. And if it really was the perfect design of an eye, there could have been things that were done better. And they'll often say things like the appendix in us is an example of something that has no purpose, has no meaning. Why is it there? It's part of a part of an evolutionary process where it was used at some stage previously but is no longer used. And so once again, you'll have kind of people going back and forth arguing with each other. Okay, so old earth, young earth. I'm moving very quickly. Young earth. This is a lecture, Nicholas. Young earth. So young earth, young earth will only be Christians who hold to an idea of young earth. And the young earth kind of holds once again to the idea that the days that were read by James are literal 24/7 hour days, and so they say therefore that the earth is around about 10 to 20,000 years old. Yes, they acknowledge that the genealogies that we read of in the Bible are missing. It's quite possible that there could be some names missing, but I think it's important to note there that that doesn't account for billions and billions and billions of years. The idea here is that men and dinosaurs lived together, and potentially the dinosaurs became extinct at the macro flood or the worldwide flood. The dating methods are incorrect. Is kind of the view here. The idea that the Earth is millions and millions and millions of years old is because our dating techniques are incorrect. One of the views here, one of the strong views, is that God created an old Earth. In other words, when God created Adam and Eve, they were 21 years old, right? Well, what's the perfect age? 25, 32, right? That's my age this year. When God created Adam and Eve, they were 32. That's how old they were. Okay, and when God created the universe, it was billions and billions and billions of years old, because the light had to travel to get here from there. And so it was that old. God created an old earth. And so that is our understanding of why the earth appears to be old. Well, it actually is old. And the kind of the comeback to, well, what about the fossils that are in the ground? Did God bury fossils to make this world appear like it's, I mean, that's, it seems like quite a trickster thing to do, that he would bury fossils underneath the ground that look like. It's one thing to say Adam was 32 years old. It's another thing to say that God actually buried the fossils to make the earth look old. The comeback there is that, once again, this is why the key to creationist idea is that there was a worldwide flood. The kind of the comeback to that is that there was this massive worldwide flood. Incredible erosion, incredible force has made the fossils look a lot older than they do. And I say this very humbly. In fact, it's Wayne Grudem who says this. It's Wayne Grudem who refutes evolution strongly, but who has a kind of a question mark around the age of the earth. And he says in his textbook that he believes that that particular view, that that the flood was the cause of the fossils looking so old, has failed to convince hardly any scientists. And so I just throw that out there. Old Earth. So the old Earth here is that the Earth is billions of years old, 4.5 billion years old. And here the view, if you're a Christian, is that it's the, what James read, is that the days in Genesis were not literally 24/7 days, or 24-hour days. 24/7 days, is that right? Is that a Bar One advert? 25-hour day or something. So the days in Genesis were not actually literal 24-hour days. They were either age-old days. So they were, day one was like a billion years old, and then day two was a billion. And or they were just, or it's just Genesis 1, as James read it, was a picture, as a story to tell us, just to summarize for us, that God created everything. And that's what Genesis chapter 1 is telling us. And they said the text itself should be read and understood in that way. And so they concur that science shows that the earth is old, and those techniques are reliable. If you're a Christian and you hold to old earth, then you will have to hold to the idea that the animal kingdom died prior to Adam and Eve falling into their temptation and sin. I think it is important to note that God only says to Adam, "You shall surely die." And so there does seem to be scope within theology to acknowledge that. Certainly, even if you believe in 6 literal days, at least the plants died, right? I mean, Adam and Eve were eating plants. So in some way, there was some kind of decay and death. But if you believe in the old earth, you kind of have to acknowledge that there was death and decay to the animal kingdom. A lot of you, I hope this is, welcome to my lecture tonight. I hope this is helpful. Some of you are looking, I hope this is okay, right? We have to do this. If you're just sucking it up, thank you for coming. I promise we'll be back to normal sermons next week. If I did this during the week, no one would turn out. So we have to do this on a Sunday. I'm moving quickly. Okay. So the view here is that day 6 never could have happened in a 24-hour period. Day 6, if we look at day 6, it's kind of like God creates Adam and Eve. He then gets them to name all the animals. He then creates a wife. Well, he created Adam. He then creates a wife. They then get married. And so the idea is that day 6 could never have literally been 24 hours. You think you've had a long day. Hey, Adam had a very long day on the 6th day. Many Christians here will say that the 7th day never ended. And so as James read there, I don't know if you noticed, but the 7th day never ended. And so many theologians say that actually we're still living in the 7th day. There is argumentation between Christians here. Some people say, no, the word day means day. Read Genesis chapter 20, it means day. And then there are other people who say, no, there are other examples in the Old Testament where the day can mean thousands of years. And so once again, you have some lovely, well-meaning Christians going back and forth arguing with each other. All right. Cool. So those are the views, and I think we need to be careful of just jumping into a camp that we like, and I would encourage all of us to study and to seek what we think, but what I will say is this, is that we need to be careful that we need to be very careful that we don't block or stand in the way of other people coming to faith because of our strong views. If you hold to an idea of 6 literal days, that is fantastic. It's wonderful. But I think you would do well to tell your friends who believe in evolution that just because they believe in evolution, it doesn't mean they can't become Christian. And you know that because you have a really good friend. And you should find a really good friend, a really good Christian friend, who believes that. And you should say, I have a really good Christian friend who believes that. And he's the most amazing Christian. And so you may have been taught all your life that evolution is true. Me and you disagree on this thing. But you and I can both be Christians. You and I can both serve Jesus together. And I think it's important that we do that. And vice versa. If you hold to the view of theistic evolution, I think you need to be very gentle with the way you speak to your brothers and sisters who believe in six literal 24-hour days. So what I want to focus on now are the non-negotiables. The non-negotiables. Because I think all of that is kind of like, I don't think we're going to find the answer in one little... to those questions. But these are the seven... Don't you like seven? I've given you guys seven non-negotiables. James gave you 7 days. I've given you seven non-negotiables. So let's get into them. Seven non-negotiable truths that if you hold to Jesus Christ as Lord, I believe in this debate, these are seven essential things that you have to believe or reckon with. Number one, you have to believe that everything that exists was created by God and He did it by creating out of nothing. Now that's important because it kind of it acknowledges that God is the creator regardless of which means or mode you decide to believe that He created. You acknowledge that God created and you acknowledge that God created out of nothing, which means that first of all you reject atheism. Second of all, you reject the idea of dualism where matter, the earth itself, is eternal. So God and matter have coexisted, which was common in some ancient beliefs. And you reject the idea of pantheism, which is that earth itself is, you know, the tree huggers. Let's go hug a tree because the tree is beautiful and Mother Nature is powerful and Mother Nature is amazing and we should bow down and worship Mother Nature. What we believe is that everything that has existed was created by God and He created it out of nothing. God alone is eternal, God alone has power, and God is the owner of the universe. Number two, God is distinct from creation and yet creation itself is dependent upon God. Creation is distinct from God. I think that's covered in the first point. But secondly, an important point that needs to follow is that creation is dependent upon God. God is involved in His creation. And so whichever view you feel represents most faithfully the view of how God chose to create, you have to acknowledge that God is intricately involved in every part of His world. And so this denies deism, the idea that kind of God created and then went on a holiday. Put my feet up. Okay, good luck, guys. You know, that's kind of the idea of theism, where God creates and then leaves it all and leaves everything to be... Nothing could be further from the truth in a biblical framework. Isaiah chapter 40 makes that very clear, as does Colossians chapter 1, verse 17, where everything is currently being held up by Christ. Then thirdly, by being created in the image of God, humans are different to animals. So number three, the non-negotiable truth. Being created in the image of God, humans are different to animals. Genesis 1:27, which James read, says that mankind was created in the image of God. And this is the topic for next week's sermon when we get back into more proper expository biblical preaching and we move away from the lecture hall of evolution versus creation. We're going to look at what it means to be created in the image of God. But for tonight, let me briefly say to be created in the image of God at the bare minimum carries this idea that we have the ability to have a relationship with God, to worship God, to know God, to walk with God in the garden as the picture presents itself. And so we all know deep down that mankind is has greater value than the animal kingdom. And so regardless of what view you have, I think you have to hold to that. If I were to give you a person tonight and an animal, and if I were to say choose who you would rather see die, all of us would rather choose the animal because we know deep down that there is something far more valuable about mankind. So I think you have to hold, if you're a Christian, you have to hold to the view that mankind being created in the image of God, humans are different to animals. Then the next four points I'm going to hit together. The slide there, thanks. First of all, I think we have to believe that Adam and Eve were real historical people. Jesus speaks about them in Matthew chapter 19. Luke refers to them in his Luke chapter 3. He takes the lineage of Jesus all the way back to Adam. And Paul, very clearly, as we might have time to look at now, spoke about Adam as a literal man in Romans chapter 5. We must believe that Adam and Eve committed a real sin and that that real sin led to what we call the fall of humanity. We must believe that Adam is the federal head of all people. And I'll explain what that means. The federal head is basically someone like a president. And so a president is an example of what it means to be a federal head. A president goes before a nation and represents them. We must believe that Adam is the federal head of all people. And we must believe that death came to humanity as a direct result of the fall. And so kind of Romans chapter 5 verses 12 to 21 is the key passage here. Let me just read for you Romans chapter 5 verse 12. We don't have time to read all the verses, but Romans chapter 5 verse 12 says this. Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man and death through sin, so death spread to all men because all sinned. And Paul goes on to develop in the following verses his idea that, his theological framework, which is key to the idea of how someone receives righteousness from Christ, is that mankind has a federal head, mankind has a representative, Adam, as a representative, as a federal head, who entered into a covenant with God on our behalf. Genesis chapter 2, which we'll get into in the coming weeks, speaks of a clear covenant that was entered into between Adam and God. And this covenant said that there were consequences if Adam broke the covenants, if Adam kind of fell short of God's expectations. And so when Adam broke the covenant and when Adam fell short of God's expectations, there were direct consequences for every single person that Adam represented. And so the thought is kind of expanded on at length in Romans chapter 5. And the key thing here is that God could not have created a covenant. God could not have entered into a covenant with a fictitious person. God enters into covenants with real people. And so we have to believe that Adam, regardless of what we believe, if you believe in theistic evolution, many theistic evolutionists like N.T. Wright or various other people will say that God took a Homo sapien who had come from a common life source as everybody else and at a particular stage breathed into them and made them different to mankind around them. And so what is key, if you hold to that view, is that Adam was a literal person. What you read, we haven't yet got into Genesis chapter 2, but what we read in Genesis chapter 2 speaks about an actual person and an actual event with actual consequences. Because if we don't believe in that, then the very foundation for which we receive the righteousness of Christ is also undermined. You see, Romans chapter 5, verse 12, which Liska read for us at the end of last week's service, goes on to tell us that all of mankind finds themselves under Adam or in Adam, with Adam as the federal head, with Adam as someone who broke covenant with God, and therefore we ourselves find ourselves born into sin. The Bible makes that painfully clear in Psalm 51, just as one example, the idea that we are born corrupt. We and this is going to be beautiful when we look at the image of God next week. We remain in the image of God, and yet we are fallen. Every part of us is fallen. Every part of us is corrupt. And it's something we inherit from our federal head, something we inherit from Adam himself. And so every single human being finds themselves in this situation. But just as Adam's sin was kind of transferred onto us, even though we didn't sin, in the same way, Paul says, the righteousness of Christ, who lived a perfect life, is transferred to the believer in faith, even though they themselves didn't live that life. And so when you undermine the historicity and the literalness of the fall, you undermine the very mechanism through which Paul says we earn our righteousness from Christ. And so yes, there are some big issues in this debate. And I think these are the big issues. That Adam was a literal man. I will die for that truth. That's a truth that I hold in a closed hand for me. Adam was a literal person. That he actually entered into a covenant with God and he broke that covenant. And as a result, every single person in this room finds themselves corrupted and living in a corrupt world. And I do believe, even if the earth is old and even if there was some form of death prior to the fall, I still believe that creation itself was also affected by Adam's fall. And so let me conclude. What do some notable Christians say? Joel, was that good enough? I met with Joel yesterday and he said, Mark, you have to hammer that point. I hope it was good enough. I've really appreciated meeting with some of my friends. Mark Matthewson in the front tonight. Had a great conversation with him. When was it, Mark? On Thursday morning. And we were supposed to just have a nice coffee and catch up, and I hijacked it, and I asked them to help me. I said I'd have a sermon to preach on Sunday. And it's a delight to know that our preaching is a community event in many ways. Let me conclude. There are many notable Christian leaders who have different understandings. And so I'd encourage you not to kind of jump into a camp. If there's any camp you're going to jump into the 7 non-negotiables, all right? Jump into those, because those are theologically true. Those stem from the Word of God that cannot be changed, that will not be proved to be untrue. Jump into that camp. That's the camp I'm fighting for tonight. And once you're in that camp, then I would encourage you, with the mind that God has given you, to engage with some of the greatest scientific minds in the world and try and answer the question of how. And let me say this, because James said this is what God's given us in terms of how. Let me say this. Even if Genesis 1-2 is about how, and many Christians, as we'll get it, Muslim Christian leaders say it's not actually about how, but even if it is about how God created, what we have to acknowledge is that there's very little detail there. And the writer of Genesis is very obviously moving through this history of the creation of the world very quickly in order to get to Abraham. Once Genesis gets to Genesis chapter 12, there's 50 chapters in Genesis. Once you get to Genesis chapter 12, everything slows down. Genesis chapter 1, 2, and 3 are kind of, there's this like thousands and thousands or potentially millions and millions of years that are just passed over in just sentences. Because the writer of Genesis is trying to get to Abraham. He wants us to know why we're in a fallen state. And then once we get to Abraham, everything slows down, because then it becomes about how God redeems us. So what we do have to acknowledge is that the Bible actually tells us very little about how. And so once we've jumped into the camp of the 7 non-negotiables, we can then use our minds to engage with the scientific world and not kiss our minds goodbye and seek to learn and ask the question, how? How? How did this, how do you, and like I said, you might conclude that the how is in the scriptures enough, more than enough, that we don't need anything from scientific minds. Okay, so many notable Christians. Albert Mohler is a kind of a leading evangelical Christian over in America. I know many of you won't know him. He's a leading evangelical leader of our day, a well-respected, writes a lot of fantastic things. He holds the idea of 6 days, and he holds the idea to the fact that evolution is debunked, and so he will be in that creationism, kind of broadly speaking, he would be in that kind of camp. And he's a leading Christian of our day. Wayne Grudem, one of my personal heroes in terms of theology. Wayne Grudem will come strongly and fight against evolution. And yet he will also acknowledge that he thinks that there's some major questions around the age of the earth. And so he would hold, I think, to an idea of intelligent design, potentially with an old earth idea. Tim Keller, one of the leading kind of scholars in our day, has the view that Genesis chapter 1 is not supposed to be read as a literal 6 24-hour day, that in his view, Genesis chapter 1 is a chant, as he puts it. It's a chant with over 50 repetitions, as James read. Over 50 repetitions, and so it was. And God said it was good, and there was morning and there was evening. And it's written in a way where it's just supposed to give us this idea that God created everything. And it's kind of like this chant. And order doesn't matter, Keller says. He says in Genesis chapter 1, you get day and night before you get sun and moon. And so he says, you get vegetation before you get rain. He says the order doesn't matter. It's a chant about the fact that God created. He says, then you get to Genesis chapter 2, which we're about to get to next week. He says, all of a sudden things change and order becomes very important, because the very beginning of Genesis chapter 2 begins to speak of how God had not yet caused the terrain, and therefore the earth had not yet sprouted up vegetation. And from there, things follow a very natural order. So Tim Keller is of the view that Genesis chapter 1 is to be taken not to be taken literally as a 6-day event, but Genesis chapter 2 is an event that speaks about actual history. So he's not saying, he's not saying Genesis chapter 1 is not literal. He's saying it's literal in its own way, in the way it was supposed to mean. Are you with me? Okay. Michael Eaton, kind of one of the well-known theologians here, goes a little bit further than Tim Keller himself, and he says that Genesis chapter 2 is kind of, it's history, but it's allegorical history. And so There certainly was an Adam and Eve. There certainly was a relationship that they had with God, and certainly was a sin. Was there an actual tree? Was it actually a fruit of the tree? Was there actually a talking snake? We don't know. It's not because Michael Eden doesn't believe in the power of God and miracles. He certainly does. He just believes from the text itself that we're not forced to believe that this was actually how it happened. It's a parabolic or an allegorical account of a historical event, if you can get that. N.T. Wright believes in some form of theistic evolution. C.S. Lewis, as much as we hold up C.S. Lewis, unfortunately C.S. Lewis falls out of the camp that I'm fighting for tonight, and it goes to show that we really can be incredible Christians and yet not have absolutely everything right. C.S. Lewis didn't believe in a literal Adam and Eve, which I think was a big mistake. Here at Church of Man, we've got Steve Johnston, who teaches at our Bible college, who holds to a six-day account and a young earth, as does my good friend Mark Matthews, sitting in the front row. And then we have Joel Sangster sitting behind him, who holds to, at the moment he's not too sure, but he kind of is more inclined towards the theistic evolution with quite a few questions. It's interesting to note that major defenders of the inerrancy of Scripture, people like B.B. Warfield, didn't necessarily hold to six literal days. St. Augustine, who was one of the early church fathers, who interpreted Genesis chapter 1 before this whole debate, thousands of years before, or hundreds of years before Darwin even came onto the scene, St. Augustine actually interpreted Genesis chapter 1 not as six literal days. And so let me conclude with this. There will always be mystery. Deuteronomy 29 verse 29 says that there are things in mystery, and for that reason we worship. And so I would encourage you to find comfort and solace in the fact that when it comes to the how, there are many unanswered questions. There are other mysteries in the Scriptures. The Trinity, the Incarnation, the sovereignty of God, along with the responsibility of mankind. There are many mysteries, and we can find peace with those. What we can say, certainly, I think, is that, or not I think, I know, is that everybody has mysteries. Every worldview has mysteries. And I think it's important to acknowledge that. And the mysteries that we have are mysteries and reasons for worship. Above all, tonight, we want to be humbled. Let me close with Psalm 8, verse 3 to 4. Psalm 8 says this: "When I look at the heavens, the work of your fingers, when I look at the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars." It was so powerfully read by James tonight that God just spoke. It describes this powerful God who created out of nothing. Nothing. I say my INGs very badly. Who created out of nothing. The psalmist here, David, says, "When I look at the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars." The stars that outnumber all the grains of sand on the seashores. There are more stars in the sky than there are grains of sand on the seashore. "When I look at the heavens and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him." And incredibly, this vast, amazing, diverse universe that God has created, he has chosen mankind to be his representative. And we just fall in humility before God and we say, "Lord, we look at your creation, we look at the majesty of your creation, and we think to ourselves, who are we, these small little people on planet Earth, third rock from the sun, kind of going around the sun, who are we?" And yet the truth that we are created in the image of God and that he has chosen to have a relationship with us.